Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now turn to the subject of the ongoing struggle in Libya. I'm now joined by Mansour El-Kikia, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's a Libyan native who has published widely on Libyan politics and society. He's the author of Libya's Gaddafi, The Politics of Contradiction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour El-Kikia.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Clearly, things are not going well in terms of the rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi and the efforts to unseat him. And I'm getting reports from intelligence sources saying that the rebels on the ground, when they call in an airstrike on a Libyan tank or some artillery, or on Gaddafi's tanks and artillery, takes about 8 hours for NATO to respond. And now we've had some collateral damage from NATO accidentally killing some of the rebels. So could you walk us through what you think is the status quo militarily?
Well, I think it really reinforces something very important that NATO is the United States. I mean, NATO without the United States really is not NATO. The Europeans don't seem to have the necessary equipment actually to be able to do the job like the United States. This is one. They lack the organizational structure within NATO itself without the United States to actually, which is really very serious. I mean, you bring up a very, very serious issue. It shouldn't take 8 hours from one person to another person to bring a strike. And so, this, I mean, here, looking, I think it's a valuable lesson for the United States as well, too. And I think the United States looks at it and says, like children playing, you know, let's see how well you do without me, okay? But it's a serious issue, and NATO really has to reevaluate many, many things now after Libya. It has to reevaluate its tactics, it has to reevaluate its communication systems, but more important, it has to reevaluate itself. What can it do without the United States? And does not push NATO in a direction without, first of all, the approval of the U.S. I mean, France pushed really NATO into this against perhaps even Obama's own willingness to do this. And you keep in mind the fact that Obama was elected on a ticket of not going to war, of ending wars. And so he won the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize. And so here you have an issue here for Obama, this cautiousness that hits Mr. Obama because he does not really want to be involved in this on the one hand, in spite of his morally saying, yes, Libyans should be free. But there's too much pressure on him domestically within the United States not to involve himself in Libya. And this is why when Sarkozy came up and says, we will do it, he says, go ahead, be my guest, let me see what you do. Okay. And apparently NATO is not doing a good job of it.
So Mansour El-Kikia, do you think this is a problem of NATO not having the same advanced military equipment that the United States has, or is this about their bureaucratic command structure?
I think both. I think, first of all, they don't have the necessary equipment. Even though they have modern equipment, they have American, I mean, it depends. The French have the Rafael and they have the Mirage. The British have their own
Tornadoes, yeah.
The Tornadoes, and they have a whole bunch of others, you know. And the Norwegians have the F-16s, and the Qataris have the F-18s, and you have a whole bunch of stuff in there. But apparently, the type of equipment that is needed is that things that can fly lower down. They can actually sight, see the targets, and then punch them out quickly. And most important of all, to do it quickly, fast. You know, as soon as you get the information, you're out there doing the work. It's a problem with NATO. If this is really as it is being pointed out to be, then NATO has to really, really look at its command structure very, very, very carefully.
Again, I'm speaking with Mansour El-Kikia, who is a Libyan native who's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. So let's turn then to the rebel army itself. It's not really an army, it's a people's army. And I think people should be aware of that. I'm sure seeing pictures of people in jeans and T-shirts fighting in modern military says a lot, at least to me. But there's also this kind of Mad Max character about it, where they're all driving around in pickup trucks in a random kind of way. What would your description of this army be?
Well, you see, you're quite right. I mean, ultimately, it is a people's army. It's people who are fed up of this regime. And they got an opportunity to rise against the regime. The weapons that they have, they actually have captured from the Gaddafi's forces himself, from his security forces. And the tenacity not going back to under Gaddafi. Now there is a small army. There's a small thing about I think maybe 3,000 or 4,000 actually professional soldiers who were part of the Libyan army who actually now defected or moved away from Gaddafi, and now they're beginning to assert their influence on the situation. But still, they lack the hardware. They don't have the arms. They don't have the military capability. Mr. Gaddafi has just hired 500 experts in his latest attack against the freedom fighters, against the insurgents from Belarus. And they actually are leading his army against them. And
just to repeat that for the audience, I had not heard this information. You mean from Europe's last hardcore dictatorship,
yes,
Belarus?
Yes.
They're sending
yes.
down professional military advisors?
Yes. Yeah, no, actually, not, they're on the field. They're actually leading those. They're actually advisors to those his commanders in his attack that actually came out of Sirte, his last two attacks. There were 500 of them, and he's paying them, I think, something like $30,000 each per operation. More importantly, freedom fighters have just caught high-ranking officers of the Chadian army. And Chad, more than 3,000 Chadians moved up to help support Gaddafi because Libri in Chad is a client of Gaddafi. And so what you have ordinary citizens trying to fight a professional armies and mercenaries. And we ask Western society in the United States, you know, and others, arm them. Give them some help. Give them training to do something with themselves. No, we won't do it. We will protect Benghazi. And so what you're going to find happening, they're going to come to the borders of Benghazi. You're going to find NATO coming in to bomb those. They move back. And then the whole thing starts over again. You know, the big problem over here, and this is really my biggest problem with Mr. Obama, even though I sympathize and I understand exactly where he's coming from, what the problems he's facing, and I understand the opposition, the Republican opposition, at least some Republican opposition within the United States to him. But you know something? He said something. He said, this individual must go. He cannot stay there anymore. Then what are you going to do about it? You cannot say something and then don't follow it up because you lose credibility that way. Otherwise, don't say anything. Keep quiet. It's better. This is one. Secondly, when you're in a position of leadership, you need to make a decision. It's okay to make a wrong decision. You can fix it, but you've got to make a decision. You can't stay undecided, too cautious, because that will lead to paralysis, and this is worse. Because no one will start believing in you anymore.
Well, how much so?
They were seeing on the ground.
But Mansour, how much is Obama and NATO circumscribed by the UN mandate, which is a limited one? It's to protect
Benghazi and civilians,
not to defeat a sovereign army. And you make it pretty clear, and I think it's worth noting, that there aren't too many Libyans left fighting for Gaddafi. They're mostly Chadians and Belarusian mercenaries.
I'm saying, but who's fighting against Gaddafi? That's the question. You said it yourself. I mean, people wearing jeans and T-shirts and slippers. They're civilians. So shouldn't we be protecting them?
Well, I would think, though, that there's got to be some. I mean, if this problem is one of the rebels saying, look, there's a Gaddafi tank in front of us, can you do something about it? And it takes 8 hours for them to react, and by which time the tank's probably moved on. I would think that, you know, the U.S. perfected this very, very mobile method of warfare in Afghanistan, where they put special forces teams on the ground with laser designators, and they use the air power in a very precise way. So,
but they haven't done that.
Well, who has? Is anybody the French?
If you don't want to do this, there are people in among the freedom fighters, among the insurgents, who can do this for them. Who can do precisely the same thing can do it for them if you don't want American boots on the ground. And I understand there's so much opposition to American boots on the ground, the opposition to British boots or French boots. But there are some. It doesn't take too long to train an individual or two or 10 or 20 people to do precisely this, to hone in on the target. But none of this is being done. Why? Because the idea, should we arm the insurgents or not? Oh, we have a problem over here. They, maybe they support Al-Qaeda. But this is what Gaddafi has been spewing all along. This is his letter to Obama the day yesterday, saying, I'm fighting Al-Qaeda. You know, he has been one of the most prominent individuals to bring about Al-Qaeda in Africa. His policies. And, see, and he tries to scare the United States and the Europeans with saying, well, Libyans are going to turn all of a sudden to Al-Qaeda. What Libya wants is to get to see the end of him and have a democratic system. They have not to be afraid. Tripoli today, a city of 2 million people, is under siege. And if you've been following CNN and been following what this woman who has been raped by Gaddafi's goons, okay, she wants to leave Tripoli, but she can't because they won't let her leave. Tripoli is under siege. Misrata is encircled with tanks and fired upon, bombing, shelling day and night. And we were and the command in Benghazi was asking NATO, please hit the damn tanks. Oh, they're in populated areas. They're not in populated areas. Why don't you do something about it? And so it seems to me what happens that the commanders are saying, you know, what are we depending on NATO for?
Well, what about, though, given that the European left and a lot of the American left feel that this is yet another example of Uncle Sam, the ubiquitous imperialist, and there's a sense that, and more than a sense, I think there's a, I think one of the subtexts for Obama saying to the Europeans, well, you guys deal with this, it, because Europe gets its oil from Libya.
Yeah.
So that seems reasonable. But in terms of boots on the ground, I don't understand why the Egyptians don't pony up. I mean, why not get an Islamic, Arab-speaking army in there to help their brothers and sisters?
Because the regimes, unfortunately, are very close to each other. The only country that's split away from them has been Qatar. And Qatar has been doing it because just to spite the others. And we're thankful to Qatar. I mean, let me tell you something. Had Al Jazeera not shone the light on the situation in Libya, no one would know about it. And Gaddafi would have destroyed half the country. Would have. I mean, as it is, the number of people he has killed is unbelievable. The Egyptians the Egyptians never want to interfere in these issues. No, the Algerians actually supporting Gaddafi with mercenaries because they don't want. None of them want to see a democratic regime. That's the problem.
And what about Tunisia?
Tunisia doesn't even have an army.
Right.
Okay. Right. So we're falling into a situation where, unlike the situation in Iraq, has never asked the United States, come and liberate us. I mean, here is a case where you're saying Libyans are saying, hey, listen, this guy has been a dictator for 40 years. We are rising up against him. Please help us. You don't want to help us with bombing them. Give us weapons so we can fight him. But now the thinking is we're taking our time to think about whether we should give them weapons or not. How long is it going to take? Will those weapons fall in the hands of terrorists? You know something? All of this is possible. All of that is quite possible, but we can never be certain about any end. I mean, the only thing we're certain about, as we always say, is death and taxes. Yes, everything else is open.
Well, let me just wrap up here at the end here and get your comment. It seems to me that this could get really difficult, obviously, for the Libyan people. It could get so much worse. A divided country is untenable. A stalemate is untenable. Gaddafi seems to have resources, even, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars that he's stolen in his personal bank account. Even in spite of the 30-plus billion that the U.S. froze, he's still got money. He can buy mercenaries. He's got the Belarusians and the Chadians, etc. So he seems to have options. And unless there's some way to integrate the rebel army with the NATO air power, this thing is going nowhere. So what's your sense of what can be done? And, of course, the clock is ticking on Obama. 60 days, he's got to notify the Congress.
That 60 days, he has to notify the Congress. You're right. I mean, this is a huge dilemma for the Libyans. I mean, you're quite right. And the Libyans, this is why you find the frustration within the council in Libya. This is why you found the head of the military in Benghazi came out and spoke and said, no, you guys in it are not helping us. And this is exactly what you're saying. This is the fear. This is the major fear in Libya. But what they have to do? I mean, what? Tell me, what can those people who have freed Libya from Gaddafi do except keep on fighting? I mean, there really is this commitment to either freedom or death, and they have no choice but to do this. If they did not believe in this, you would not find that kid in blue jeans and a T-shirt with it riding a Toyota attacking a T-62 tank.
Well, Mansour El-Kakir, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mansour El-Kakir, Libyan native who's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas. He is the author of Libya's Gaddafi, The Politics of Contradiction. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the drug war in Mexico, where thousands demonstrated yesterday about finding a way to end this agony.
ليلة من الليلات لقيت بناته وهي بالذات قالت لي احنا جاي.